morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lorein. Coming up today, we're going to hear Florida This Week, which is a discussion about state and local politics. And it's a program that originally airs on WEDU-TV, the PBS station here in Tampa. As we listen back to today's program, I hope you'll email us here in the studio. The address is to write is dj@wmnf.org. Let's listen to Florida This Week, and then we'll open up the phone lines later in this hour. This is 88.5 FM. Coming up next, Florida's top Republicans are all backing President Trump in his decision to not concede the election. The number of COVID-19 cases in Florida is rising as some parents in Pinellas criticize mandatory mask policies in schools. And can Democrats turn Florida into a purple state again? Our guests are Rick Wilson from the Lincoln Project, Democratic State Representative Anna Eskamani, Dr. Jason Wilson from Tampa General Hospital, and veteran journalist Adam Smith, next on Florida This Week. Welcome back. Florida's most prominent elected Republicans are standing by President Trump in refusing to concede that Joe Biden has won the presidential election. Both U.S. Senators Marco Rubio and Rick Scott, along with Governor Ron DeSantis, Florida's Republican members of Congress, and Attorney General Ashley Moody are standing behind the president's claims that it's not over. DeSantis has even encouraged legislatures in other states to ignore the voters and pick Trump as the winner. And Moody has joined a GOP lawsuit to throw out some ballots in Pennsylvania. And while President Trump is blocking the transition of powers, the nation's coronavirus crisis is getting worse. Across the country, the number of new cases is spiking. And here in Florida, we are nearing 900,000 total cases. We've already had nearly 17,500 deaths. With that as background, some parents of Pinellas school children spoke out at the school board meeting this week, angry that mask wearing was being required in schools for staff and students.
Epidemics have not occurred in schools, regardless of mask usage. The mask mandate is not about health, but about compliance, and we do not consent.
For everyone that's speaking up in favor of the mandates, I promise there are at least twice as many of them with a brain that are adamantly against them.
In the end, the Pinellas School Board voted to extend the mask mandate for 3 months.
Anna Eskamani is the Democratic representative to Florida House District 47. She won her latest race for the Orlando Area District last week. She's a native of Orlando, has several degrees and a PhD from the University of Central Florida, where she's also served as a professor. And Anna Eskamani, welcome to Florida This Week. Great to see you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
What do you make of the top Republicans here in Florida going along with the president and saying that he's right not to concede the election?
It's incredibly disappointing. I mean, we see the numbers. The votes are majority have been counted. And at this point, any votes left over are not going to change the outcome. We know that Vice President Joe Biden and Senator Kamala Harris are going to the White House. And it's really important that President Trump support a peaceful transition compared to his behavior right now. And the fact that Florida Republicans are just toeing the line reflects that they care more about pleasing President Trump and appealing to that base of voters than speaking to the needs of everyday Floridians, where we continue to navigate a COVID-19 pandemic, huge unemployment, and Floridians who really need support.
November 3rd was not so good statewide for Democrats, and some people are now saying that it's proof that Florida is a red state. It's a solid Republican state. Do you agree?
I push back against that definition. You know, here in District 47, we flipped this legislative seat in 2018, and we kept it in 2020 by a larger margin than 2 years ago. And in fact, we flipped four precincts in my district, including two precincts that voted for President Trump in 2020, but also voted for me. And I think that speaks to the notion that it's not about red versus blue. It's about building a rainbow coalition where we can speak to every type of Floridian and meet their needs. And in my district, as an example, whether it's Floridians that live in very wealthy communities who have concerns about their health and safety or their quality of life, or it's going to a hotel lobby where Floridians can't afford rent and are living in hotels instead of actual apartments. You know, we have to be able to meet people belly to belly where they're at. And I do think the Democratic Party has done a poor job in building that type of relationship with Floridians.
And I know that the NRA has given you low marks, but you got pretty good marks from the Associated Industries of Florida. Would you consider yourself a progressive? And if you do, do you think progressives can take the formula that you had there in your Orlando area district and make it win statewide?
Well, I don't know if 60% from the Associated Industries of Florida is a good one, but I'm definitely very anti-big business and do my best to hold corporations accountable. I do call myself a progressive because I don't take money from organizations like AIF, and actually I don't attend their events either. But the fact that I have a 60% marking from them versus 50% demonstrates that I am able to work across the aisle to create an environment that's good for workers. And in particular, this past legislative session, I supported deregulation of certain fields when it comes to licensing, so more Floridians can enter new job markets and start new careers, which is something we desperately need with COVID-19 as well. But I do think progressive issues can win, because the only entity that loses with progressive issues are corporations. You know, we want to make sure that corporations pay their fair share of taxation and don't influence the political process like they do today. Every Floridian pays into this system, and yet corporations find loopholes where they don't have to. And they also exploit workers at the same time. They built the broken unemployment system Floridians have been dealing with. They don't support moving rapidly towards renewable energy. So these are issues that are quite compelling, and they center on the needs of everyday people. And that's why we're so successful in our district. And that's why I do think a progressive message would be compelling across the state of Florida.
Yeah, Representative, I think you're known for two things. One is constituent service, but the other thing is you did this time around, and you did 2 years ago, is that you had a ground game. And a lot of the fault of the Democratic Party this time, a lot of the complaint is they didn't have a ground game. Why did you continue to do a ground game when most Democrats did not?
So we took COVID-19 as a serious public health concern. So we did freeze all of our field operations in March of 2020, but we didn't stop them. We just converted them to focus on public health. So instead of knocking on doors, we started doing phone calls. And instead of asking for votes, we asked, how can we help you? So we provided constituent services with organizing skills to actually get to listen to our constituents. And as a result, we helped over 30,000 people across the state of Florida with their unemployment claims. And then in the late summer, we put back into play our field operations, but only through no contact literature drops, maintaining our phone banking. And then near the end of the pandemic, we did social distance canvassing to get out those last voters. So I never saw COVID-19 as a reason to stop old field operations. I saw it as an opportunity to reimagine what field looks like. At the end of the day, if you're going to cut through the noise and the lies that so many leaders in the Republican Party of Florida use in order to draw fear and get votes, you have to have a presence in neighborhoods. Even though we couldn't knock on doors, seeing our T-shirts, seeing our volunteers, talking to folks in their driveways while they're smoking a cigarette or talking to someone working in their garden, those were all opportunities to build a relationship with our district. And it helped us secure an even larger victory than in 2018.
And Escobar, I didn't have a chance to ask you whether or not you want to run for governor or U.S. Senate. I hope you come back and we can ask that question of you when you come back. Anna Escobar, thanks for coming on Florida This Week.
Thanks, Rob.
Rick Wilson is an author, commentator, political consultant, and editor-at-large at The Daily Beast. He is also a co-founder of the Lincoln Project. That's a group of Republicans who want to hold accountable those who would violate our Constitution, in their words, and put themselves before Americans. Their best-known target is President Trump. Rick Wilson, welcome back to Florida This Week. Great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Every elected Florida Republican, from the governor to the U.S. senators to members of Congress, is going along with the president on this idea that somehow the election was stolen. Even when the president says things that are dubious, every elected Republican in Florida goes along with the president. Why do you think that is?
Well, these are profiles in cowardice, first off. They're afraid of a mean tweet. They're afraid of Fox News saying something bad about them, or Breitbart saying something bad about them, or the president, you know, again, with the famous FOMT, fear of mean tweets. So he's broken all of them psychologically. And the irony is, the reason they all decided they would play ball out of fear was also coupled with their ambition, because Marco Rubio and Ron DeSantis and Rick Scott all want to be president. They all think of themselves as leaders from a state that could be a huge political advantage in the national election, and they all think they're going to be president. They recognize that for some period of time, after Trump is gone, which he will be gone in a very short window, that a major part of the Republican base will still be the Trump base. They will still be Trump voters. And they're afraid of the 2024 Republican primary, with one of their competitors running a piece of video that says, you know, here's where Rick Scott was mildly critical. Here's where Marco Rubio was mildly critical of Donald Trump, and turning it into a campaign killing exercise. So they recognize the Republican Party has been eaten by Donald Trump and his followers. It is no longer a party about their ideas or anyone else's, except adoration of Donald Trump.
There are some news reports that say that President Trump would like to run again in 2024. What do you make of those?
I welcome his decision to run in 2024. It makes our work that much easier, because if he continues to suck down all the oxygen in what was the Republican Party, I think in four more years, Donald Trump, his legacy will be seen in a much clearer context. And that is not a compliment. His legacy will be seen for what it is, which is a disaster for this country and for the American people. And so I'm quite convinced that we're in a situation where Trump could easily decide to run again. He would freeze the field. All these ambitious guys, whether it's in Florida, Rubio, Scott, DeSantis, and Gates, who all want to run for president someday, it would freeze those people in place. But also Josh Hawley, Tom Cotton, Ted Cruz, Mike Lee, Nikki Haley, all these people will be stuck. They will have made a bet that they would be rid of Trump this year, or at the latest in 24, and he will still be there to haunt them, even if he is a geriatric version of himself in 2024. His power over the Republican base will still be very, very pendant in their minds as a threat. And so I think it's going to be a very ugly time if you're a Republican candidate who wants to run in 24, because Donald Trump will dangle, whether he intends to run or not, he will dangle the possibility until the last possible second.
Ron DeSantis and Marco Rubio are going to be on the ballot in 2022. Will the Lincoln Project be active? Will you be working against them in 2 years?
Well, we'll make assessments across the country in 2022 on our targets. Marco has been a particular disappointment to many, many Republicans who thought he was a man of principle and was going to stand up to Trump in some way. Never did, never could, never would. And, you know, Ron DeSantis mortgaged himself and the state of Florida to Donald Trump on the subject of COVID in a way that has had devastating impacts on the people of this state. As for Rick Scott, you know, that's a longer term question. But we're going to look across the country at the enablers of Donald Trump who are up in 2022 and assess where they're vulnerable and make a choice at that point as to whether to start, you know, exercising our abilities and our skills to move numbers in those elections.
I've read some critics on the internet writing that although you raised a lot of money, the Lincoln Project raised a lot of money, after you spent that $70 million, you weren't able to peel away that many Republican votes. What
except
did you find?
For the states we targeted, called Arizona, Georgia, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, which where we spent probably 75% of our resources this year. In those states, we absolutely did move Republican votes. We also prevented the people that had already left the Republican Party, largely a cohort of independent-leaning, Republican-leaning, college-educated men and women, from drifting back into Trump's orbit, and we moved them over to Joe Biden. We'll be releasing metrics in the coming days that our analytics have shown that the effect we were able to have in these key swing states was dramatic. And a lot of people confuse what the Lincoln Project is and does. It's like an iceberg. Up on the surface of the water, they see the flashy viral video ads, the ads that are meant to mess with the president, which they did, and as a strategic decision to screw with Donald Trump's head and his campaign. very effective in that. But they don't understand what's underneath the waterline. It's a massive data and voter contact operation. It's a massive analytics operation. So we always test and know where our messages are working and where they're not working. It's a targeting system that we've built essentially with the same capabilities as a national political party that we were able to deploy very smartly in places like suburban Atlanta and in metro Philadelphia and in the T of Pennsylvania and in places like the surrounding counties around Milwaukee. And we were able to accomplish things we never thought we could when we started the operation, which looked in the beginning, we thought we'd raise $4 or $5 million, raised about $80 million. 94% of that went to voter contact. So we are in a position where we think the after action report on the Lincoln Project is going to be pretty strong.
Rick Wilson, thanks for coming on Florida this week. I hope you come back.
Happy to be with you. Talk to you soon.
Well, there's been a sharp rise this week nationally in the number of COVID-19 cases. That's also true here in Florida, with the state reaching infection and death rates not seen since last August. Dr. Jason Wilson is the Assistant Adult Emergency Room Director at Tampa General Hospital, and he joins us with an update. And Dr. Wilson, welcome back to Florida this week. Great to see you.
Thanks for having me back, Rob. You seem to always have me at the worst of times.
Yeah, sorry about that. We've seen some parents recently in Sarasota and Pinellas County complaining about mask mandates in schools. It happened this week in Pinellas County. Let me play you some examples of what the parents said.
Parents of Pinellas understand that this is not normal across Florida. Roughly half of the kids in public schools across Florida aren't wearing masks, and commissioners, you represent us.
It's just ridiculous. It's taking away our children's civil liberties to be able to breathe and the God-given right to be able to breathe without this mask.
Jason, a lot of parents showed up this week in Pinellas County and said they don't want their kids to wear masks. What does science say about kids and masks and coronavirus?
Sure. So everything we've seen in a peer-reviewed study has demonstrated that masks are incredibly effective for essentially a free or very cheap intervention that really has no risk to anybody, that really has no adverse effect on anyone. We really have a widely available public health strategy, intervention strategy that decreases viral transmission. The CDC guidance around masks got even stronger this week, recognizing that masks don't only protect other people around you, but they also protect you from getting virus. So the street is really both ways. You know, when things were really surging in June and July, we surveyed patients coming into our emergency department for testing, and we asked them if they wore masks or not. This is before we had the mask ordinance in Hillsborough County. And this is when the positivity rate was about 30% in this area. And of our patients, those that wore masks always or sometimes tested positive about 30% of the time. Whereas patients who wore a mask rarely or never, their rates of positivity were about 75 to 80%. So pretty clear difference in those two groups between mask wearing and not mask wearing. And we know that wearing a mask for people who are asymptomatic with the virus decreases transmission to other people exponentially, meaning not just, you know, a few other people are going to get the virus because you have it, but really divide that by a factor of 4 or 5 less times the number of people will get virus if I wear a mask and I'm asymptomatic. Masks don't hurt you. They're essentially free to wear, and they massively decrease viral transmission and protect you. We need to wear masks.
There's another storyline emerging this week that suggests that if you've already had COVID-19, you should go out and celebrate and do everything that you normally do before the COVID crisis because you're impervious to getting the disease again. What do the scientists say? What do the medical scientists say about the chances of getting COVID again?
So this overall is not a public health strategy that's been vetted by any public health experts. And you're not going to hear any public health experts say right now that that's a strategy we should employ. The problem is there's a lot about this virus we just don't know. Fortunately, it does seem that if we mount antibody to virus, we have some protective benefit from the virus in the future, and that's good. And we probably are at less risk of reacquiring virus, but we don't know that for sure. We also don't know a lot about viral mutations and viral changes. We've seen not much clinical change in virus mutations so far, but we're still in the first big season of this virus. So there's a lot we're still learning. So right now, that's not a strategy for public health experts that we would recommend, or that you would hear recommended by a public health expert. This kind of goes along with something like herd immunity, which is also a vaccine concept, not a public health mitigation strategy for virus, because we know that if we keep on seeing cases go up, the incidence rate continue to rise, and we end up back where we were in June or July, our healthcare system was on the breaking point at that period of time. Whatever the actual number of cases were, it was enough to really push this healthcare system in Florida to the breaking point. And if we go over that, or we push it again, we could be in serious trouble. And so the numbers you have to get to herd immunity are really, really, really high numbers. And so we need to do the best we can to socially distance ourselves from other people, 6 feet apart, try to stay out of indoor gatherings, and wear masks. People get sick of hearing it. I know people have virus fatigue at this point, but the virus is still here, and the virus doesn't care about our calendars. And some of the best public health advice we were giving out in April and May is still great public health advice. It's just boring type of advice, but it's the best advice we can give, and it does save lives. And the data clearly demonstrates it saves lives when we employ those strategies.
Jason Wilson, thanks for coming back. One of these days, we'll have a better conversation about something a little bit happier. But Jason, thanks for coming on Florida This Week.
It's part of being an ER doc, Rob. I get people want me around at the bad time, so I'm used to it. But I'm always happy to come back. Thanks.
Well, Adam Smith has spent more than two decades following Florida politics as a reporter and editor at the Tampa Bay Times. He's currently a senior vice president at Mercury Political Consulting and joins us now. Adam, great to see you.
You too, Ron.
Now that the smoke is cleared, what's your best analysis about why the Democrats did so poorly November 3rd, losing congressional seats, losing legislative seats, and losing to President Trump by a big margin here in Florida?
Well, we have that question to answer, seems like every 2 years in Florida. But I think the big reason, there are a lot of reasons. One is that Donald Trump simply had an extremely fired up base. But probably the biggest reason is Miami-Dade and Trump's somewhat surprising appeal to Hispanic voters, not just in Miami-Dade and Cubans, but especially Cubans, where the rap on Joe Biden and Kamala Harris has been socialists actually worked.
So if they change the leadership at the Florida Democratic Party, does that fix their problem?
I don't think it does anything. I think fundamentally their biggest problem election after election is money. And I don't think that's the only way they're going to get more money is if they get more influence in the state legislature, because for better or worse, special interests are what fund these political parties primarily. And that requires juice in Tallahassee.
So we're headed into a U.S. Senate race. Marco Rubio is up for re-election. Ron DeSantis, the governor, is up for re-election in 2022. Who are the Democrats likely to put up? What names are being batted around?
Well, first, I don't believe there's always some speculation that is Rubio going to run again. I think he absolutely will run again. And I think, as we are all talking about, I think Rick Scott and Rubio and Ron DeSantis are looking at president in 2024. The big race is going to be governor. And I think the bad news for Democrats is a lot of national money probably is going to be reluctant to come into Florida, invest in Florida because of the poor showing this cycle. But the Democrats you hear, Gwen Graham, Anna Eskenazi, Jason Pizzo in South Florida, who am I forgetting? Sean Shaw one hears, and obviously Nikki Fried.
Yeah. So does being tied in 30 seconds, does being tied to President Trump 2 years from now, 2 years out, do you think that that's going to be a positive or negative for candidates who are running statewide?
I don't think it's going to be I don't know if it's a wash. I mean, right now he Trump obviously lost, but he still has a very, very excited base. The good news, if you're Ron DeSantis, you no longer have to every day have to be answering and responding to some crazy controversy that Trump has generated day after day after day. So I think in some ways he has, it's clearly good news for him that Trump is no longer going to be as much on the front lines, because knowing Donald Trump, he'll still be news constantly.
Adam Smith, I'm so glad you're still out there, and I look forward to having you back. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks as always, Rob.
Well, finally, the November elections are behind us, almost. The Democratic process is just about complete for this cycle. The great Leonard Cohen wrote a song about times like these. Stay safe. We'll see you next week.
That hopeless little scream, but I'm as stubborn as those garbage bags that time cannot decay. I'm junk, but I'm still holding up this little wild bouquet. Democracy is coming.
Well, that was Florida This Week from WEDU-TV, a program that I host on Friday nights. Adam Smith, the former political editor at the Tampa Bay Times, now with the Mercury, was on that program. So was Dr. Jason Wilson, MD, from Tampa General Hospital. Rick Wilson, co-founder of the Lincoln Project, was there, and State Representative Anna Eskamani from the Orlando area, Democrat, maybe a rising star in the Democratic Party. All my guests on the program, if you want to comment about anything that they said, you can email us here at WMNF. The address is dj@wmnf.org if you want to comment about anything that my guests said. And if you're interested in what we've been talking about for the last 25 minutes or so, Sean Canaan is going to take a deep dive into the November 3rd elections and talk about the strengths and weaknesses of the Democrats and Republicans in November, on the November 3rd election here in Florida. So it's going to be a good program coming up in the next hour. So again, if you want to comment about anything you've heard here so far, you can also call us right now at 813-239-9663. That's 813-239-9663. Here's some of the comments that we got from listeners while we played Florida This Week back. David writes, I'm tired of these anti-mask people. I would love to see them punished for non-compliance with some jail time. That's David's opinion. And here's an email from another David who says, the Lincoln Project is awesome. I think they really helped to defeat Trump. I hope that they'll continue to go after Trump loyalists like DeSantis. The 60-minute segment on the Lincoln Project from a few weeks ago was really great, writes David. And then Liz has a different opinion about the Lincoln Project. Liz writes, Lincoln Project is not a friend of progressives or people who stand for justice, such as the listeners of WMNF. Just know that their next target is progressives that they like to brand as socialists. The Democrats won the presidency. We are not going to put Republican ideals into practice. Be careful, voters. Don't fall for their tricks. These are still conservatives, and they think we on the left are radical socialists. I call BS, writes Liz in Spring Hill. Well, we'll see what they do. They certainly have a knack for putting out interesting ads and raising a lot of money. And as Rick Wilson said, he seemed to have it in for Florida's senior U.S. Senator Marco Rubio. We'll see what they do with their money and their talent. 813-239-9663. Timothy writes, what about kids wearing masks in countries that are successfully keeping their citizens relatively free of COVID? Is the science aware that dentists in Sarasota are claiming that wearing masks increases cavities? Disinformation, question mark, pseudoscience, question mark. Grateful for your qualifying questions to increase the information coming from the interviews, writes Timothy, who's in Sarasota. And then Kevin writes this, Florida's trifecta of Trump lapdogs, Ron DeSantis, Marco Rubio, and Rick Scott, proved once again that fealty is alive and well in Florida politics. Sad, very sad, writes Kevin. Well, if you've got some ideas you want to share about these topics, you can call us up at 813-239-9663. Frank Knox is our phone producer today. He'll be taking your question, your call as you call in. I think we've got a problem with line one still, so there may be a time that you call in or that somebody calls in and then gets dropped off because of the buzzing on line one. Let's go to Ron in West Tampa. Ron, what would you like to say?
Hey, Rob. Well, you know, going back to, of course, the election last week, particularly, you know, Biden, he won Arizona. He won Georgia now, amazingly. And, you know, the counting is done, so in a nutshell, I would say to all people, remember 4 years ago, I didn't like that Trump won, but I accepted that he won fair and square. I think he won by the same electoral vote count, ironically, that that Joe Biden did. So, you know, I think it's, you know, shameful. There's not really any dignity or decorum that Trump is showing, not surprisingly to me. And he barely has acknowledged Biden's win. So it's what he's doing now is kind of like what I call the scorched earth theory. He's trying to just kind of take down the Department of the military, you know, the Department of Defense, and he's replacing them with all his lackeys. And it's just, it's again symbolic of kind of a destructive, divisive attitude that's reminiscent of a petulant child, you know. And I wanted to touch on one other thing. You had a caller who said that she had tried to call Rick Scott's office, and I wanted her to know, for what it's worth, if she's listening, I've had the same problem. You know, he's my senator. I didn't vote for him, but he's my senator. And after about five or six attempts to call him within a month, I just simply gave up. Now, I did get what I call a cut-and-paste email from his office, but I never got a call back, and I never got anything referencing what I specifically had contacted him about. So I think that speaks volumes, too.
Okay. All right. Well, Ron, thanks a lot. Thank you for calling in. And we'll take some more phone calls at 813-239-9663. Let's go to Gary in Clearwater. Gary, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
You know what? Could you answer a question for me, Rob?
I can't answer every question, but go ahead. What would you like to ask?
Is there a chance that Trump won't be running in 4 years from now because he'll be in jail?
There are a flurry of articles out there that say that President Trump, because he will be leaving office, no longer enjoys the immunity from prosecution that he's enjoyed for the past 4 years. And the New Yorker had, I think, the best article. You can look it up. It's written by Jane Mayer, and it came out November 1st. The president does face a host of legal questions about his taxes, about his treatment of women, just many, many issues. Whether or not there'll be any sort of criminal charges against the president, or whether or not he'll, you know, face fines or jail time or convictions, I don't know. But I think it's a possibility. Certainly it's a possibility. And there's a lot of good articles out there. We played one of those articles written by Jane Mayer just 2 weeks ago here on MNF. So it's a possibility, Gary. But there's no crystal ball here, so we can't see clearly into the future.
And it really amazes me that when I heard that 70 million people vote for Trump, that many people don't believe in science.
Well, I think people have a variety of reasons voting for President Trump. They are not all of one opinion. Some, I think that masks are bad for you, or that masks don't help, or that masks should be a choice. But I think there's 70 million reasons to vote for President Trump, and so it would be hard to sum up why somebody, you know, using just one slogan or one idea, it'd be hard to sum that up and. For 70 million people, just like it would be hard to sum up why people voted for Joe Biden, 77 million people, or whatever that number is. But, Gary, thanks a lot. Thanks for asking those philosophical questions. 813-239-9663. Email address dj@wmnf.org. And let's go to John, who's in Tampa. John, thanks for calling. What would you like to say?
Hi, this is John. I think you're on the, am I on the line?
Yeah, yeah. We just introduced you, yes.
It's John, not John. Not like that really makes much of a difference. But thanks for taking my call, and I enjoy your show. I just wanted to clarify about something you brought up in the beginning. Somebody wrote in about a dentist saying that the mask caused cavities. So I own a dental laboratory, and the issue with the mask and causing cavities is more with children than adults, and it has to do with mouth breathing. So when you breathe through your mouth dries out, and then it becomes more acidic and more susceptible to cavities. So that's basically, I mean, that is a true thing as far as the possibility to create a bad environment in your mouth for, susceptible for more cavities. But like I said, that's more to do with children than adults or anybody who has the mask on and then is breathing through their mouth.
Yeah, it sounds like it's an issue of mouth breathing, and it exists with or without masks. So people have to be encouraged to breathe through their nose.
Yeah, exactly. So, basically the children, more so than adults, have to kind of be taught how to breathe properly when they have the mask on. Because what I see, and I mean, there's a big difference between adults and children. Kind of, you could tell an adult or somebody who is mentally able to understand a concept, something pretty simply, and then they can call it, like, just don't breathe out of your mouth because you have the mask on. But children do all kinds of weird things, like they stick their mask inside of their mouth, and they tend to breathe out of their mouth. You could see it if you're ever around a child with a mask on. You could see that the condensation will be around their mouth as opposed to around their nose. And that's because for whatever reason they're, feeling it's a nervous tic or something, but they're breathing out of their mouth.
All right. I got your name wrong. Did you say it was Don and not John?
Sean.
Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah. Now I got you. All right. Sean, thanks a lot. Thank you.
Okay.
I mean, that's really a question of training, too. I mean, just like, kids train to throw a baseball or throw a basketball, train them to breathe correctly. That would seem to be an issue of training and not an issue of making it a bad idea to wear masks. Let's go to Teresa in St. Petersburg. Teresa, what's on your mind today?
Well, first, Trump is never going to concede, and I guess that's fine. It really ain't going to matter. And there'll be a lot of people that will never accept Biden as president, just like there were some that never accepted Trump and never accepted Obama and Bush. I mean, that's just the way it is. But the majority of us, we all had to get over that Hillary lost, and eventually we all did, and Trump was our president, and fortunately we lived through the last 4 years, not a lot of us, but some of us did. And what's going to happen in 2022 with our state, I have no idea. I don't know who they're going to get, so I guess we just have to wait and see what's going to happen.
Okay, Teresa, thanks a lot. Thanks for your phone call. All right, great to hear from you. Terry writes this, you choose, or if you choose not to wear a mask in public, you should have to be at the end of the line for vaccinations, writes Terry. That's Terry's email. Thank you, Terry. And then Linda writes this, I don't remember who, but someone on your Florida This Week program said that one of the reasons the Dems lost was money. I thought Michael Bloomberg sent lots of money to Florida to help with the election. What am I missing from this? Adam Smith said that the perennial problem for Democrats here in Florida, especially for state legislative races, is that they don't have money. Bloomberg did send $100 million, he said, to Florida to help swing the presidential election. I don't think Bloomberg is sending any money for state legislative races. We'll see. He might in the future. We've got state legislative races coming up in 2 years. We just had a slew of them, and we'll have more in 2022. But I don't think Bloomberg sent any money to state legislative races, and that was Adam's point. Well, there was a really interesting interview last night on Peacock, which is one of the NBC channels. It featured Mehdi Hasan, the host of the program, interviewing Paul Krugman, the New York Times columnist and economist, discussing what should President-elect Biden do when he gets into office. And let's listen to a little bit of the interview. We're not going to hear the whole thing. But this is Mehdi Hasan speaking with New York Times columnist Paul Krugman, talking about what should the first steps of the Biden administration be when Joe Biden becomes president.
Today was announced that there were 709,000 jobless claims nationally, with COVID rates exploding, death tolls sure to rise, and more closures likely. What would you say to a President Biden, Paul, were he to call you up for advice on January 21st? What's the first thing you would tell him to do on the economy?
Oh, the most immediate thing we need to do is a relief packet. I mean, we've managed to basically squander all of the achievements we got in fighting this virus over the course of the past 8 months. So we had a crisis in March, April, to which we responded much better than you might have expected. We responded with extra aid to the unemployed. It was really not stimulus, it was disaster relief. We tided people over while we did the necessary, during the period of high infection rates. And now we should be doing that again. Unfortunately, we screwed up. We allowed this thing to explode again. But we have an end in sight. It looks like there will be a vaccine sometime next year. So what we need to do is to get through the next, whatever it is, something like 8 months, without a mass casualty event. But that means that we're going to pay a heavy economic price, and we have to give people enough aid to survive that. So basically something that is like the aid that we did back in March, but more extensive, more covering the gap than that. But, that none of that can be done without legislation. So if it's a Republican Senate, it's not going to happen. The economics is really very simple. The economics is just build a bridge to the vaccine. But is that actually going to happen? And I have severe doubt.
Yes, indeed, don't we all? But here's a question for you. Joe Biden himself, and in terms of his own governing agenda, he long represented Delaware, which is ground zero for the credit card companies. He was once referred to as the senator from MBNA. I think you yourself criticized him in the past for favoring Social Security cuts, for helping to pass the 2005 anti-bankruptcy bill, which you called draconian. I wonder, do you believe, can he really now be a FDR-style progressive president?
Well, the thing about Joe Biden is that he has always managed to be in the dead center of the Democratic Party. And the Democratic Party now is much more solidly progressive than it used to be. It's not actually the party. I mean, obviously there's wings. It's not the party of AOC. It's not the party of Bernie Sanders. But it's the old Democrats who were almost indistinguishable from Republicans have pretty much left the scene. And Joe Biden, everything we see. I mean, it's worth pointing out that during the Obama years, people I know, when looking at the economists, there was only one economist in the Obama administration at a senior level that progressives would have said, yeah, he's one of our guys, and that was Jared Bernstein, who was Biden's economist.
Yes.
So Biden actually represented the most progressive economic agenda within the Obama administration. So I don't really worry that he himself is some kind of closet conservative. I think, and in practice, given the likely political situation, he will be as progressive as he can be. The question is whether he can be progressive enough.
So one way, some say, to prove his progressive bona fides in office would be to make Senator Elizabeth Warren his Treasury Secretary, a job she reportedly wants. Would you back that move? Would that be an important and symbolic appointment in your view?
It would certainly be important and symbolic. And I'm a huge admirer of Elizabeth Warren. I don't think it should be a litmus test, put it this way. I mean, there are some arguments that he would be using political capital. I have a problem here. Normally, I keep my distance from everybody, but I'm both a great admirer of Elizabeth Warren, and I'm also Lael Brainard, who is from the Fed, who is often touted as an ex-student of mine, so I'm a little bit too close in a way to the people involved. And my guess is whoever it is, if he were to pick some Wall Street executive, then I'd say, oh, wait a second, alarm bells. But none of the people that we're hearing about, whether it's Warren or Brainerd or Janet Yellen, is something that should have progressives politically upset. So I think he should just pick who he thinks can do the job best. I don't think that's going to be, I'm not worried about that particular appointment. I think the personnel thing is just overstated.
Back in February, you told Christian Amanpour that in some ways it didn't matter who Democrats nominated for president because, quote, the Democratic Party these days is solidly progressive, what Europeans would call a social democratic party. Yeah. Now, I would say it's barely social democratic, still some way to go on policy, no universal health care still. And yet Republicans go the other extreme and paint everything coming out of the Democratic Party, from Joe Biden of all people, as socialism or even communism. Is it possible to have a serious discussion about economic policy in this country, the kind of policies that are mainstream in the rest of the West, when you have this constant and childish obsession over the S word?
Okay, well, it's not possible to have a discussion with Republicans. Everything is socialism. And if given a chance, suddenly Medicare and Social Security will be socialism too. I mean, anything that you do to help people in distress is socialism in their book. And given that, the political constraints, if Biden can actually implement his health care plan, it's not Medicare for all. But it actually would get us a long way towards universal health coverage. So, you know, that, and now because Democrats underperformed down ballot, now we're worried about whether even that is going to be possible. But I think if we actually got the things that Biden is proposing, it would be a significant move in a progressive direction. We would get up to near universal health care coverage. We would have a much stronger safety net. We'd have much more generous family policies. So it's not that the agenda is, you know, it's not the agenda that the left of the party, or even I myself, if I had a magic wand to make all these policies happen, I would go for Medicare for all. I would go for a whole bunch of things. But the agenda that he has is plenty progressive enough, and it's unfortunately probably more progressive than he's going to manage to achieve.
So let me ask you this. You mentioned that it's not possible to have a discussion about socialism with the Republicans, but the problem is that discussion now is not happening with the Republicans. It's happening within the Democratic Party. Since Election Day, we've seen so-called House moderates become obsessed with the word socialism, saying it cost them seats in places like Florida. They've been, you know, attacking, quote-unquote, you know, members of the squad and you see Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez pushing back. We had Ro Khanna, progressive congressman on this show last night, pushing back, saying, no, you know, we need to have clear economic messaging. Isn't that the problem right now? Where do you stand on this divide in the Democratic Party right now? Do you think left-wing economic policy, socialism, cost them seats?
My guess is, my advice would be don't use the word. I think that just, you know, saying I am a socialist, when you actually aren't, I mean, people who in the Democratic Party who call themselves socialists are just social Democrats. And so that's a little bit of self-indulgence, and I don't think we can afford self-indulgence there. On the other hand, I don't
see... But what about the policies, Paul? Because they're actually attacking the policies, too. They're attacking the policies, too.
Well, I think we should be able to say... I think it should be okay to say I'm for Medicare for all without denouncing Obamacare 2.0, which gets you a good part of the way there. And by and large, by the way, in the general election, they did. I mean, Bernie Sanders was very well behaved on this. And for that, and what I would say about the moderate Democrats is that they are laying too much blame, even though it was self-indulgent to say I'm a socialist. But they're laying too much blame. The Republicans would have found somebody to attack anyway. And the bigger Democratic problem is not the message, it's the organization. You know, look at what Stacey Abrams managed to do in Georgia. And it wasn't because she tacked to the center, it wasn't because of any of, I mean, she was barely visible, but she got the voters out. And so the big Democratic problem is not that the message is too far left, but that it just hasn't invested in the get out the vote capital.
One last question. We're almost out of time, and I have to ask you this. Thanks to Trump and the Republicans, we're also running record deficits and debt, and yet the GOP is already signaling they're going to become deficit hawks again at exactly midday on January 20th, 2020. It almost seems as if Republicans understand that Keynesianism works, stimulus works, borrowing works, but they're just trying to sabotage a Democratic president and agenda again. How should a Biden administration respond?
It's just say what Republicans have actually discovered is that hypocrisy works. Obviously, they don't care at all, really, about deficit. It's only a club with which to beat Democrats. And the fact of the matter is there's no problem. I mean, it's, the markets, you know, if we're supposed to worship the markets are telling us, please take our money. We're willing to lend it to you at interest rates below the rate of inflation. This is not there's no hint at all out there in the world that current levels of U.S. debt are a problem at all. And it should not be.
Yeah.
It should simply be, I mean, you should just make fun of the Republicans for
Well, that was Paul Krugman last night on the NBC Peacock channel being interviewed by Mehdi Hasan on the question of are Democrats socialists and a lot of other things, too. If you want to comment about that, you can call us up at 813-239-9663. Tim writes this, is it possible that the rocket of COVID cases increases that we've been seeing since the past month may be linked to Donald Trump political rallies? How can we learn more about the White House staff and the current president's staff relative to COVID infections? There are a lot of good newspaper reports out there about the rallies and about the president's staff and the COVID cases. So I think the best way to learn, I'm not going to read a whole newspaper article right now with 3 or 4 minutes left in the show, but there are some great articles out there about the president's staff and COVID-19. And also the rallies and the connection between the rallies and spikes around the country. Doug in Clearwater writes this. He said, I said after the election, when Biden wins, the hard work begins. Biden should work on the environment on January 21st, and that would give the economy a boost. I think the question is an important one. What should President Biden do when he becomes inaugurated? When he's inaugurated on January 21st, what should be the first steps he takes? We heard a New York Times columnist, Paul Krugman, there say that he should work on COVID-19 relief and help the people that have been left behind during the COVID crisis. And that emailer there, Doug, said that the president should work on the environment. What do you think? 813-239-9663. Junior writes this, in 4 years, the only thing people will remember of Trump is his ribbon-cutting ceremonies for Motel 6. And Junior goes on to write, we should consider, however, what is going to happen to all that irrelevant Chinese regalia. Those huge Trump flags are useless as COVID-19 masks. They're made from the finest sweatshop poly-something or other, writes Junior. And then Jeff writes this, I heard some talk about socialist-type funding as a bridge to a vaccine, but I'm thinking some company will make a lot of money on the vaccine, so I'm thinking that actually helps capitalism in the long run. You know, the government support for developing COVID-19 vaccines has been huge, and I think we're going to talk about that this week on one of the segments. We're going to talk about all the tax money, your tax money that went into developing the vaccines that look promising at this stage. And one of the questions is, should the vaccines be free and available to everybody that wants one? And we don't know what the price structure is going to be for the vaccines. They could be free. But then some of these companies may charge. We don't know. We've got an open line, 813-239-9663. Let's go to Steve in Lakeland. Steve, what's on your mind today?
Well, I wanted to illuminate something that was said about money, which also involves leadership as well in the Florida Democratic Party. According to Daily Kos, the 10 times as much money got spent for Republican candidates for the state legislatures across the country than for Democrats. And I would imagine that this amount was exaggerated here. there was not support given to state legislative candidates, even though it's a census year. And this is, frankly, the third consecutive census year in which the state leadership for the Democratic Party has not made a priority of winning seats.
Okay. Well, Steve, I'm sorry to say we're out of time. We're going to talk more in the next hour about the state of the Democratic Party and the state of the Republican Party here in Florida. So stick around for that. If you want to comment about today's show, please call us at 813-238-8001. Record your comment about this show on extension 115. We'll play those comments back tomorrow.